Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We're just discussing our ailments. Don't you worry about us.
You kids don't know anything.
Well, good morning. We have a great panel this morning. I'll introduce them in just a second. Just a reminder, if you'd like to be a part of this little party, and why wouldn't you want to be a part of this party? You can write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Undoubtedly, we'll get to a subject that either you want to weigh in on, makes you irate, or just you want to send some panel love, whatever the case may be. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is directly across whatever this table is to us.
Yo.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm just...
You're the Iron Horse.
Well
You're
said.
The Iron Horse. Alan is doing a project right now, and he's in the knee deep in it, and he's persevering, and he's doing great, and so
Thanks.
It's all good.
Thanks, Joe. I need
suck it
that.
Up, cupcake.
Jen Smith is the purveyor of that. Jen Smith is a Berkshire Eagle reporter. Education is her beat, but really, she covers everything, don't you?
A little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. And we are thankful that every Wednesday we can count on your presence here. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me back.
The district attorney for the County of Albany joins us this week again, and usually with us on Wednesday, joined us earlier in the week, but we're thrilled to have him back. David Soares, good morning, sir.
Well, I did find out that there are incredible benefits to Mondays. The chair assignments, the beverages apparently are fresher.
You get beverages?
There's beverages.
I don't get beverages.
Oh, yeah, Colleen usually comes on with beverages.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. All right. Do you want a beverage?
No, I was just playing the victim.
Okay, all right. And our good friend Rich Honan is here. He is a corporate attorney, and we love when he's on the program. And so here he is, and we're thrilled that you're here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Nice to
good
be
to
here.
See you.
Good
always
to see you.
Like catching up. All right. We're ready. We're ready. We're all caffeinated except for Rich, and we're ready for a show. Okay. Let's get to the stories at hand. The big story, of course, coming out last night. Was some information that we got that there was a possible presidential subpoena. Robert Mueller had raised the possibility of a presidential subpoena in a meeting with Trump's legal team. This goes back to the month of March. In a tense meeting in early March with special counsel Robert Mueller, President Trump's lawyers insisted that he had no obligation to talk with federal investigators probing Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. But Mueller responded that he had another option if Trump declined. He could issue a subpoena for the president to appear before a grand jury, according to four people familiar with the encounter. This from the Washington Post. Mueller's warning, the first time he is known to have mentioned a possible subpoena to Trump's legal team, spurred a sharp retort from John Dowd, then the president's lead lawyer, which I want to get to in a second. This isn't some game, Dowd said, according to two people with knowledge of his comments. You are screwing with the work of the president of the United States. The flare-up set in motion weeks of turmoil among Trump's attorneys as they debated how to deal with the special counsel's request for an interview, a dispute that ultimately led to Dowd's resignation. So this fills in some of the blanks for us as to what was going on. I remember vividly, Alan, when we were talking about this, you saying, well, we don't know what happened behind closed doors, and now we are getting some sense as to what's happening behind closed doors.
Well, the question, of course, is always who leaked it. Mueller has not been leaking anything. So my assumption is that the Trump people, I already see a grimace on Rich's face.
Well, you say who leaked it. My question is who didn't? They said there was four. Their sources were four people from the meeting. How many people were at the meeting?
That's a very good point.
It's I think the majority of the people at the meeting went and leaked it, it sounds like.
Yeah, well.
I think that's been confirmed because what, in fact, was leaked were notes that Jay Sekulow had taken during the meeting. And so it's impossible for the people in this case, the representatives from the Department of Justice, to have leaked what they did not possess to begin with.
I have a prediction.
Yes.
I predict this business of the subpoena and its legality is going to end up in the Supreme Court of the United States. And I further predict that Justice Kennedy will be on the side of good.
That's a pretty strong prediction, pretty good prediction. First and foremost, I'm a little disappointed in the way you read the Dowd comments, because it should have been, this is no game.
Yeah.
Something like that.
You're screwing with the business of the President of the United
States.
Right.
More thespian. I was hoping for a little more thespian there. But certainly the limits of constitutional power of the president are going to be tested in this over this discussion. And generally speaking, other presidents have had that opportunity to test those limits, but because of the court of public opinion, they were less inclined to go there. And in this situation, you have a president who is not very much concerned with the court of public opinion.
So my little Joe brain is having trouble figuring this one out, which is what?
Keep going.
My little Joe brain is having trouble figuring out, because about this time, if this happened in early March, this is about the same time that we were hearing that the president was not the direct target of the investigation, correct?
Target was used, okay, but there's a difference between being a subject, being a target, and being a witness.
And you would still be subpoenaed no matter what you are.
You can be a subject, right? And the difference between you being a subject and a target could really change in minutes.
Okay, but if you put yesterday's story, which was, here are the questions that Robert Mueller wants to ask the President of the United States, and the information that we learned late yesterday from, I believe it was the Post that broke the story, about this subpoena, then you put those two together, it certainly seems like he's a target of a criminal investigation.
I don't know that you could say that.
Not yet.
I don't know that you could say that. I think that what the special counsel is looking for is completeness, and he's going to be authoring a report of some sort. And the idea of authoring that report without having some answers provided to him from a very important source of information, I mean, I would be looking for that opportunity myself. Now, what you have to ask yourself is, did the raids that occurred in Cohen's office several weeks ago change, the perspective of the special counsel with respect to how he's viewing the President of the United States at this moment? And that we don't know.
I think in the Post, too, has an interesting breakdown. So we know that the Times published the full list. The Post has highlighted seven questions that are being asked, which are a little bit more indicative or worth some pondering in terms of the direction that the investigation is going and when Trump is actually being specifically named in the line of questioning. So I think that's worth a look as well, just to get better context of where this is headed.
I also think that there should be some clarity here, because I cannot see a prosecutor ever sitting in a room with the subject or target of an investigation and saying, hey, by the way, I'm going to ask you these questions. Now, I think what happened is, you know, these people were in a room together. There's plenty of discussion going on about the investigation, and notes were taken. And those notes were taken based upon the conversations that were being had. There is no prosecutor that's ever going to provide a list of questions to a witness, a prospective target, and then begin a negotiation. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, but not in that context, but it could have happened in the context, and I know we're really extrapolating here, but it could have happened in the context of discussions.
I love you two lawyers talking, Duke and I. This is good.
He's the expert, okay? So I'm just
we have both sides here. We're good. This is good.
I think you could have that conversation in the context of a negotiated conversation, a negotiated interview, right? I mean, you certainly were discussing things like, well, if I was going to let you talk to my guy, what would we be talking about? What would the ground rules and areas and things like that? And if you can believe anything, I don't know if you can, but if you believe what was going on, it looked like there were some discussions about maybe having that kind of conversation. So I could see these questions and these areas of interest coming out of those conversations, right?
Yeah, I definitely see that conversation taking place. What I don't see is the prosecutor really, defining what they're going to be asking the questions. Now, if you're on the other side, given the fact that this is the president of the United States, and this is a person who has access to an incredible amount of information, I can see you really wanting to safeguard, you know, those other interests that he may have. For example, you're not going to get into any questions about national security.
Right.
And a council is going to, you know, really do their work to make sure that there are clear boundaries that cannot be delved into.
But there was no collusion.
Whatever that means.
Well, right. it also raises the question of, you know, what's sort of the end strategy or the outcome? You know, do you think that in your expertise and your analysis, is it a strategy to look towards impeachment or exoneration and with all the evidence collected?
I don't think that the evidence collected and the effort that's been put into the special investigation is working its way towards exoneration. Quite honestly, I don't believe that the professionals at the special counsel's office have a clearly defined goal in mind. They're gathering evidence, and it's where the evidence is going to lead them. Now, what I can say about the president and his advisors, you know, these are people that are definitely trying to try this case in the court of public opinion by continuing to leak information and pummel the credibility of the special counsel, and they're using members of the conservative House caucus to do that. And so that is an aggressive campaign and something that even in courts of Albany County you see, because the defense attorneys can in fact speak, and they will do that, you know, quite often, and we're prohibited from speaking about cases because of the chance of poisoning a jury. So what I see is actually, you know, a brilliant job on the part of the administration in continuing to pummel the credibility of the special counsel.
Did you have
only that I don't agree?
Okay, well, let's get duke that out, and then I'll ask a question.
Well, it's not much. It's just that I think the special counsel Mueller knows exactly where he's going. I think the indictments that have come forth, I think, create a real roadmap. And I think in many ways, you know, the Mueller has played this to a T, because, you know, David, you may be right that they're not allowed to talk, and they don't. But just watch their actions. Watch Manafort. Watch Gates. Watch the people that have been who have been indicted. I think it's a pretty good roadmap as to where it's all going. And I think it's going to go, and I believe in it, by the way, to impeachment. I know that many of our listeners don't agree with that. They think there should be an election, and that should be what happens. But I think the law is the law.
Well, I just for point of clarification, what I was suggesting was, I think it's pretty clear now by the number of indictments. If you look at the number of Russians that have also been indicted, good luck with trying to get them here
to actually
prosecute. But I think if you look at the volume of cases that they have been able to put together, I think it's pretty clear where they're going. I think I take exception to this idea that once an investigation begins, that the prosecutor, you know, will know where it's going to end. I think once you gather evidence, it gives you a clear indication of where it is that you're going. It's just that you don't start out that way.
Wait.
Well, but it's different in the context of a special prosecutor, though, right? Because the special prosecutor is presented with, you know, more facts and allegedly a more defined role than the prosecutor who has, you know, a series of facts presented to him or her.
Well, if you accept the idea, which I do not, the sitting president cannot be indicted, and you have to wait until after. Now, they keep spouting this stuff on the air. Well, it's a well-established principle that a sitting president can't be indicted. You have to wait till afterwards and the rest of it. I don't think that decision has ever really been made.
I think it has, actually. I think it's very clear that you have to go through the impeachment process to kind of divest them first of their standing as president. Mm-hmm. And then you go – no one's saying they are not – no one's saying the president is immune – well, I guess the office of the president is, you know, is immune, right, to criminal prosecution.
That's what's being argued,
right? Yeah. Because you have to stop being president and then be prosecuted. Yeah. Basically, I think that's pretty well said.
But Rich, I really, David is the expert as well as you are. But I truly think you take it to the absurd. I used to say it about Nixon, if he shoots Pat, God forbid, you know, he's not indictable before witnesses. Are you kidding?
Correct.
I mean, that's, you know, that's, well, that's what you say. It's not what I say.
Well,
I
that's
say
what the Constitution and James Madison says too.
What's going to happen Madison. Here is you're going to have my people I love very dearly, constitutional nerds, will be the people who will be litigating these issues for some time to come, well beyond what I think the term of this president is going to be. But with this case in general, it's going to be very difficult for, I think, your members of the Supreme Court to sit back and observe and say, okay, well, if a crime has been committed here and there's evidence that points to this person, and, you know, we are saying that we are a nation of laws, it's going to be very difficult for those judges to sit back and accept a constitutional reasoning as to why this person shouldn't be.
I agree with that.
It's true, though.
But the Constitution...
Just about 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, but the process is you have to be impeached first. Now, I don't want to get into...
So you say.
Well, I don't want to get really wonky. The question would be, what if Congress did not impeach? Could the Supreme Court then mandamus...
Yeah.
Basically, could the Supreme Court then say the law is that he must first
get
be
all
impeached?
That's
or the other way around.
That's an interesting question.
Or the
it's
other
like
way
Mitch
around.
At home today.
Yeah.
Or the other way around. I mean, I think the tapes tell us a lot. The Nixon tapes, no question about it. They said, okay, executive privilege ends here.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org. Just having you here, seeing you dance in the studio. I like that. Welcome back to the roundtable. We have Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, David Soares, and Rich Honan making up the panel. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you to take part in our conversation. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. And we have a couple of letters that we'll go to, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Roger wants to know, Mueller's question list. What was the purpose of Trump's legal team to leak Mueller's questions? I don't think Mueller's team would leak them, and I can see no advantage to Trump for his lawyers to leak the questions except to try to smear Mueller once again. Thanks, Roger. I think you got it right, Roger. I think this was an attempt to say, you see, we can't get an even break here. They release stuff when we all know, or should know, it wasn't the Mueller team.
Yeah, I actually don't think that was the intent of the leak. I think the intent of the leak is to demonstrate how vast the area of questioning that he's going to go in, so that, you know, the supporters in the House, and as well as other people who have been supporting the president in this endeavor to smear the special counsel, can now complain about the fact that he's operating outside, you know, the terms of his designation.
And that you're now talking about, quote, you know, criminalizing presidential decisions, because now you have all of the people talking about, well, if he's allowed to fire somebody, if you can legally do that, and can we inquire into his motives? You know, when does presidential prerogative, you know, conflict with criminalizing that conduct?
As in, why did you fire Comey?
Yeah. And he comes out and he says, who cares why I'm allowed? And what do you do with that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the burden is certainly on the people to demonstrate that, you know, that firing took place as a result of some malevolent intent to obstruct an investigation. And
well,
that's a very that's difficult to establish.
Tough. I don't know how tough. If you now have the Russians in the room with the president and hear the president saying with his own mouth, don't worry about this Russian thing. I just got rid of Comey.
You mean that's the same thing that Obama whispered to Putin that time on the open?
You know, Rich, you are so predictable. It's always
yeah, but you never know when I'm going to pull it out.
It's
though.
Always
that's
two
the thing.
Wrongs make a right. Right.
I knew the dancing he was warming up for something. Well,
I'm sorry.
I would say Mueller's best friend in this instance is in fact Donald Trump. I mean, here's a person who cannot be controlled, and any lawyer will tell you that how difficult it would be it is to work with difficult clients. But I don't know that we've ever seen a client this difficult that has a Twitter account that will do whatever he wants. And even in moments where you think you can trust him to stand in front of a microphone and say maybe two or three words, he goes off on a tangent and ends up doing himself
in. And that may be proof of mental illness, by the way. You know, the idea that everything that you do is somehow justifiable and that it's okay. There was a thing I heard on a TV. That's the way we pronounce it around here, the TV. I think last night or this morning, in which, you know, he can't find, he's having trouble finding lawyers. You guys know about this stuff, lawyers. He's having trouble finding lawyers. And one of the things they said is, the reason he's having trouble is he won't do what he's told. But number two, he won't pay them. He ends up not paying them.
I think the attorneys are more offended at the fact that he won't take their advice than probably the money, because I certainly could see counsel who, you know, maybe they're developing a practice or looking to get notoriety for their practice, deciding to take this, you know, this case on for that specific purpose. But, you know, every attorney wants to be successful in whatever it is that they're doing. And if you're being undermined by your own client, well, then that's not something that I think many want to take on.
Which is why everybody's getting fired. Well, I don't only mean the lawyers. I mean the cabinet and everybody else, because they won't do what he wants. They have different views.
Also, don't underestimate, you know, when you have a charismatic, if you want to call it that, a charismatic, strong-willed client, it's really hard when not even dealing with a president, but when you're dealing with high-level either political officials or even business people who are just so used to kind of by force of will kind of carrying the day, it's really difficult to have those discussions as a defense attorney. Because the first thing they say is, I can handle it. Let David Soares ask me whatever he wants, I can handle it. And you know he can't handle it, you know, but they carry the day with their personality.
So what do you do, Rich? I'm assuming you're a really high-priced, very good lawyer, and I know that.
Well, at least high-priced.
No, you're a very good lawyer. And what do you do when you're faced with that?
I haven't done a lot of criminal work in a long time. I mean, my highest-profile criminal case ever was Jim Coyne back in the old days, and he was, and even then it was difficult because you know he wanted to do things a certain way. But what most lawyers will tell you is, by the time you get to my age, you're used to the fact that people are going to pay you a lot of money and then not listen to you. And so you say, look, here's what now, if you think the person's obviously going to commit perjury, then you got to get off the bus. Or if you think, all right, you're going to lose, you say, I'll do my best, but you're going to lose. You memo it and you move forward.
The political defendant or the political subject or the political target is perhaps the most difficult creature to rein in and control, because they have a public persona. Their natural instinct is going to be, look, if I show up at a ribbon cutting and I'm asked certain questions, their natural instinct is to spin and engage. And when you're telling them, look, you can't do that, you can't even talk to them, and you have to shut the operation down, that's not something that they're inclined to do. I remember way back when we were investigating the state comptroller, you know, we looked forward.
Not this comptroller. Alan Hevesy.
But when we were investigating that case, every public appearance we had them recorded, transcribed, and there were things that were being said that we used in order to further our case. Now, I can tell you that just sitting back and listening to this president and reading the Twitter accounts, they must have four or five people designated just specifically to all public statements.
Oh, at least. And I think going back to the content of the questions and the impact that it has, you know, one, you know, how does any response that gets tweeted out in the coming days and weeks, how will that affect the case, and how can that be used to cross-check what's been said in the past? And then from a public perception standpoint, I think really having these questions out there can impact the results of the midterms.
Oh, yeah. So you guys, you lawyers over there on the other side of the room, thank God. I wanted to ask you.
Wow.
Lawyers. I'm not a lawyer.
Tell us how you feel, Alan.
Wow.
Tell us.
I'm not a lawyer.
Start quoting Shakespeare in a minute. Go ahead.
But I want to know whether or not I forgot what I was going to say, which is what you did on purpose, Joe. I know.
No, I honestly did.
Jen, you know, you were talking about, you know, and David was too, you know, the public statements and things like that. Yeah, I think one of the legal issues is also, let's say this all happens. Mm. Right? Let's say, so you go through and through some fascinating cases at the Supreme Court, and somebody says, look, he was subpoenaed, he's got to go, okay? And let's say he then wants to take the Fifth Amendment. Has he waived his right to take the Fifth Amendment by all of the statements? But
can you imagine a president of the United States taking the Fifth Amendment?
I don't know if he's capable of it.
Remember, we had that whole, the woman for the IRS woman. Where she made the statement and then invoked her right, and everybody said, hey, what? You can't do that. But she did.
I remember what I was going to say now. Right?
I think the invocation comes in whenever you want to invoke it, and whether or
is
not.
That right?
Yeah.
So John Dowd, let's take him. He quit, right? The lawyer?
Yep.
So, and we're examining motives. The president won't do what I'm saying to him and the rest of it. I like to think maybe we were a fly on the wall at his house. And I don't even know if he's married, but let's assume it's his wife sitting there with him and says, John, just get out of there. This is eating you up. You don't need to do that. That simple. No?
Well, you know what? I go back to the fact that he has a reputation.
Who?
John Dowd.
Yeah.
He has a reputation. I think that attorneys of you know, his status and his stature are people that have their pride. They have a lot of professional pride. And if you're not going to use, you know, him for what he is best at, which is being able to guide you through these very complicated storms, if you're unwilling to listen to him, then sure, he could sit back and just collect a paycheck.
Yeah, but you know, David, there's a legal process, there's a political process, and that's what's getting confused here.
And the problem for the political defendant is that their radar is never where it should be in terms of navigating
the
legal side. And
it's
that's
actually
why
counter.
You hire.
It's actually counter to
exactly.
It, right?
But you telling me that John Dowd didn't know going into this what he was going to be dealing with John Donald Trump? What kind of lawyer could he have been?
I don't think Donald Trump was the problem. I wasn't in the room, but I don't know that Donald Trump was the problem. I think it sounds to me, as somebody who's been in those rooms with other lawyers, basically, Trump could have listened to Dowd, or he could have listened to somebody else, and he said, I'm going to listen to the somebody else. Well, and that's the thing that you can't take.
I think it's confirmation. He suffers from confirmation bias, right? He is never going to listen to anyone who doesn't agree with him. And so he tends to listen for the person who is going to say that which he likes. He likes to fight. He likes to swing. And moments like this where you should be engaging in deference, where you should remain silent. I mean, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And so
he's not good at that. He's not capable.
But not only that, it's not only that. And again, this goes back to the charismatic thing. And this is something that, and I'm actually going to put Trump and Obama in the same room for a minute.
For a change.
Well, there's a dance coming before.
No. think of this. You know what? You say, Mr. President, I'm telling you. And what he would say, and I think what Obama has probably said in different circumstances is, you know what? All the experts told me that don't get in the primary, right? All the experts said you're hurting the party. All the experts said, you're just going to make a fool of yourself. All the experts said, you're not going to win the primary. Then when I won, all the experts said, you're not going to win the general election. And so for all these years, all of you experts have been telling me stuff, and I've been confounding you. And the reason I put Obama there is I think you could say the same thing. How many people told Obama, you're messing up the primary with Hillary. You're hurting the party. And I think after a while, you start saying, look, I don't have the deference to the experts that maybe— you know, maybe I had before all the experts were wrong about me. And I think that's part of the community of beliefs that you're dealing with.
I agree with you. I think that if you're a leader in any position, you have people around you that are always going to offer you their best advice. And there are times that you're going to accept that advice and you'll get bitten by that. And you become distrustful sometimes. And then there are times when you know, you sit back and you engage in that quiet reflection and say, thank God I listened to so-and-so, because it could have been so much worse.
That was a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and look, in leadership, the most important – I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
The most important – you know, in leadership, there's only two questions. There's when do you listen to the subordinates, and when do you override? And, you know, just across the board, those are the only two questions. And that's what we're seeing right now.
I have to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. I think we have a couple more letters. And we have other thoughts. I think we only got to one letter because, you know, we're a very spirited conversation. This is all good. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We have letters. We'll get right to those, then we'll move on to other topics. This will kind of further along our conversation as well. Go ahead, Alan.
Norm says, President, collusion would have happened before, in capital letters, Trump was elected. Since he was not president at the time, why should he be allowed to hide behind the title of president? Thanks for the show. Norm from Clifton Park.
That is an interesting question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he's interesting.
Thanks for the question, Norm.
Because right. He's the president now.
He's
right?
President mm-hmm. now, right. It doesn't absolve him of guilt of past crimes.
It doesn't absolve him of guilt, but I think that in the furtherance of the theory of this collusion, which is not a crime, but the collusion, it's the firing of Comey, which he did when he was president, that is being used as
brings
evidence of, yeah.
That's right. And thanks, that's the new norm. Thanks to Eileen for the firing. If the questioning about the firing of Comey can't be determined in terms of what Trump did fire him to thwart his investigation, can't he be questioned as to what the grounds for firing actually were? In other words, do we get a question whether Comey was fired for just reasons, or do we accept the sudden and impulsive move of this president without any true grounds for the dismissal? Is he, parentheses Trump, accountable to say why he fired him or anyone he fired?
I don't know. Is he?
He should be accountable.
I suspect
not. Do you think
not.
He should? No. No. Do you think he should be criminally accountable for that?
I don't
That's
know.
That's the question. I mean, politically, I would like to know why the president does things.
I think there's a slippery slope when you get into the questioning of any individual for doing something that lawfully they're able to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, you know, if you have an at-will employee and you decide to terminate that at-will employee, you know, the idea now that you're going to be questioned about that decision is something that, so, you know, quite honestly, the rules should be there before that's done. And in this instance, there is no rule there.
So for all your kids in the room, I want to refer to one of the most popular men in America, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, who was fired at will by the President of the United States, who said, you did something I didn't like, you're fired. Goodbye. Of course, it cost them the House of Representatives and everything else, but as I remember it. But yes, that's a pretty important thing to remember. You're right, David.
Okay, all right, next letter.
Thank you, Joe. Fascinating that Trump's own lawyers leaked Mueller's questions so that their advice would reach him through Fox, whom he pays more attention to than his own lawyers. Well, there's a number
that's
of assumptions
That's an interesting
there.
Theory. That's an interesting theory, although, quite honestly, that would be brilliant on their part if they did do that.
It'd be scary.
Well, Luke says, serious question for Rich. Rich, would you take Trump as a client? Why or why not?
Oh, hell yeah. Hells yeah.
With a Z.
Because when...
He may get to you.
To have the chance... yeah, right. I have enough non-paying clients, as it turns out. To have the chance to argue these constitutional, I mean, I never get, you know, I'm a corporate guy, you know, we don't usually get to argue issues, you know, of this kind of moment, you know, and then to be able to argue about, you know, the essence of the Constitution and the role of the judiciary and, you know, the role of the president and this whole idea of inquiring into people's minds for their motive. I think the issues alone are fascinating. Listen, I have two adolescent, well, now post-adolescent kids and an ex-wife. I'm used to lots of people not listening to me, okay? So I...
Me too.
So I'm used to my clients not listening to me. I would take it in a minute.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I was driving around the other day thinking about the the House oversight of, you know, the executive branch, and in this instance, how it is being pulled. And the example of that is the summoning of leadership at the Department of Justice to provide documents to the body that's the oversight body. And, you know, if you're the Department of Justice, if you're in the midst of an investigation and you understand and you respect the authority of the Oversight Committee.
Meaning the Congress.
Meaning Congress. Yeah. I mean, you want to be respectful, but at the same time, you know that whatever it is that you're providing to them is going to be used as political fodder, you know. And the reality is this idea that members of Congress are going to question whether or not there was probable cause for the FISA warrants to be issued, that is an incredible overreach of their constitutional authority. That is the role of the judiciary.
So it comes down to a single word, Nunez.
What we're seeing is the boundaries of constitutional authority and balance and the separation of powers being tested almost every single day.
Well, there's that, and we also can't lose track of the other issue that this whole case has been raising, which is, you know, our stances on foreign relations, policy, and security, and what that does for the country in the long run. And I think that's still sort of, we're not hearing enough about that. You know, how are we protecting our elections as midterms are coming up? And that's something that, you know, really will also have long-term impact.
Yeah. The foreign involvement in our campaign has just been trivialized because of the partisanship of both parties. But this whole issue is just we forget that, by the way, guys, we were tampered with. There's no there is no question about that.
Well, I think
both tracks are both important to look at. You know, what precedents will this case set for, you know, not only the powers of Congress, the powers of the administration, what role judiciary has in our country, but also, again, what is happening in the future in the midst of everything else that's going on in the world.
Jen, I would think you as on the journalism side, the hoops that the Judiciary Committee had to, or the House Oversight Committee had to go through to be able to get documents from the Justice Department. I mean, to me, it seems you've dealt with FOIA requests and things like that. And this, the fact that Trey Gowdy has to go and examine documents, in a secure compartmentalized room and not make copies. They have a constitutional oversight function. I actually disagree. I think that I'm sorry that justice is busy. Okay, but it's Congress's job. It's they're elected officials. They're supposed to oversee. Jen, have you ever had to fight to get access to documents like this?
I mean, all the time.
That must be infuriating.
Well, I'd like to just take a turn here and check in on this. I think you're wrong. And here's why. I think that what the people in the investigation know is that this guy Nunez and the creeps around him are trying to wreck the investigation. You see, that's very important here. It's not as if you assume that, you know, there's an honest discourse going on here. Quite the contrary. They know that Nunez, who was hiding in the bushes outside the White House, is up to no good here. He's also on the Trump team.
And so the Justice Department is allowed to use that animus to say, we're going to make it as hard as possible for you to get documents in your oversight function because we don't like the way in which you're doing your oversight.
I think they do what prosecutors do every single day, which is balancing the interest of furthering the goals of transparency and democracy and not compromising the work that you're doing right now to hold someone accountable. And that's exactly, what they're doing. The problem I have here is that, we have these constitutional checks in place for a reason so that we don't have abuses. But the men and women who currently serve in our Congress, this behavior that they're engaging in. This I'm playing for this team, and you're playing for this team, and every day we have to try to score points. They're doing this at the expense of our country, of our nations, of our institutions, and those valuable principles that you're talking about. And that's what I find so offensive. But yeah. Trey Gowdy, you know, of all of the players, you know, whose names you hear, here's a man who did that job. And so the idea, and I understand you're a politician now, I understand what your polling numbers show, I understand what your funders are saying and how they're feeling, but there's something that is greater than yourself, and that is what we agree, and that's this democracy.
And they got to know that.
But aren't you, I'm just surprised that you're not similarly offended by the non-elected officials, the career officials in the Justice Department substituting their brand of ethics and their opinions and saying, because we don't like this, we're going to make it as difficult as possible for you to get this information.
You mean
I don't think that's any better.
It's not saying that they don't like him. We're not going to make this available. What they're saying is, look, here's, I got 1,000 pieces of paper here. If I turn over all thousands without redactions or without considering everything else we have going on, I will be turning this over for purposes of transparency, but I will be compromising the mission of the organization.
All right, we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan has more letters. We have much more to talk about. We'll be right back after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we have a wonderful panel. Rich Honan is here, David Soares, Jen Smith, Alan Chartok. He's got the letters. He'll continue with those right now.
I will, but I also want to say I'm really enjoying today's program. You guys are great. It's wonderful.
A good group.
It's wonderful to hear from
we're
all
just riffing
three
off of David. He's carrying it, and we're just doing the
call. Raphael says, good morning, panel. If an at-will employee is fired, the employee files a complaint that he was fired based on his age, race, or other protected class. Doesn't that call for an investigation into the intent of the firing? If the firing violates federal law, isn't the employer penalized? Why is it wrong to question the president's decision to fire Comey? I love your program. And that's from Raphael.
There's a lot there.
Because the answer is if the reason given was a pretextual reason, if the reason given for somebody's firing was really based on race or some bad reason that you're not allowed to fire somebody for, then you're allowed to inquire into that.
Yeah, but there was still
because then it would not have been a truly at will firing. But in this case,
he's the president.
It has nothing to do with him being the president.
Yes, it does.
He has an absolute legal right to fire the guy.
Right.
I would argue, regardless of intent. Now they're making the argument that maybe that intent goes to prove something else. Mm-hmm. I suspect that intent is going to be one in a series of things.
It's trying to get at the issue of intent to see if he was trying to compromise the investigation. And I think we've got to be very careful here. And we're jumping in a variety of different lanes. We're having the constitutional discussions about, you know, the limits of authority and power. I certainly don't mean to be commenting on exactly the fact pattern that's taken place here. So talking about the right to fire an at-will employee is something entirely different than suggesting that I either agree or disagree with the firing of Comey.
All right. Let's see. And then we'll go to Roger, who says, what was the purpose of Trump's legal team to leak Mueller's questions?
Did we do this one?
We did. Okay. I don't think Mueller's team would leak them, and I don't really, I can really see no advantage to Trump for his lawyers to leak the questions. Okay, so we did that already, and thank you very much. Go back, and you can get this online, can you not?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think we read that letter, though. I think the letter was repeated.
Really?
Yeah, that's all right. Keep going.
All right. Paul,
so who do we blame? Do we blame Sarah for
this?
No,
we're going to blame
the doctor. We're not going to blame Alan.
No, but we'll just check the collation.
Sounded
see
that
if
way.
It, no.
Paul says,
it was my fault.
That's funny. Paul says, leaks. I think we're getting played. The leaks are deliberate. No way for lawyers in a room to agree to confirm a story without also agreeing that they're leaking to the press. And then there's more.
I agree.
But we sort of
so what they say at the top of that story, Joe, four people? How many people were in the meeting?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's four people that cooperated, and we're assuming that it wasn't Mueller, his team, or the president, so there you go.
Right.
And Mario says much the same thing, Trump and the court of public opinion. Trump is very interested in, quote, the court of public opinion. The difference is that Trump is able to manipulate and, to some degree, control public opinion. Well,
Can I take some issue with that? And because, David, you made this point before about how, you know, the prosecutor, you know, the defendant and his attorneys are allowed to kind of operate in the court of public opinion and use that. I will say the Manafort raid. And the Cohen raid. These were both raids of arguably non-flight risk, white collar alleged criminals. He certainly would have had the discretion to not do that. Somebody made a decision, and part of that had to be the idea of sending a message. So I don't think that's any less public. A point than somebody making a statement about something.
But your assumption may be wrong. It was just about the law.
David knows that they had. Well, they were trying to.
There's nothing more frustrating. There's nothing more frustrating than investigating a case and going through, months, even years of remaining tight-lipped and doing a case, and then the minute you bring in an agency that has to execute something. There is a leak, and all of a sudden you're being called, from the press, being asked questions. We experience that routinely. The other thing that we experience is also watching, the other side strategically manipulate social media and manipulate the media to their cause, which then forces us to put more in the documents that we're submitting to court than we would ever, consider including. That's why when the special counsel has provided information or has filed information, reporters are getting that information, and they call these documents speaking, these pleadings are speaking. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's because it's the only, tool that ethically can be used to sort of answer a lot of the claims that have been put out there, weeks in advance.
But why do they need to be answered? Why do those? I mean, if we're talking about the court of public opinion, why do those claims? Other than unless you're saying something about tainting the jury pool, which I understand would be more locally, I understand that being more of an issue. But if you're in the prosecutorial situation, why do those claims need to be answered? Why can't the defendant stand up every day and say he's a liar, he's a crook, this is all a bunch of garbage, and then the prosecutor goes and makes her or his case in court?
Because with that silence, and it's again, it depends on the case, but with that silence, especially if it's a case that has a lot of attention and there's an appetite for information. Mm-hmm. In the absence of answers, people are engaged in speculation. There's nothing like waking up in the morning and driving into work and you're hearing individuals on the radio, much like what we're doing today, speculate about your case. And that in and of itself will also help the other side shape the opinions of prospective jurors. And so as a prosecutor who can't stand there day after day having to address those issues, you take that opportunity to do it in the most lawful and ethical way, which is in the documents that you're filing.
And it's the context of the situation, too, of being, again, a very public case that can inform future policy that affects future cases. I mean, that's why we, as reporters, are calling your offices, because we need to know that information so we can translate that for the people who are paying tax dollars in some cases, into what's happening.
All right, let's go to some other subjects and talk about other stuff. And did you want to read one more letter there, Alan?
No, it
okay,
just
you're
escaped
good.
Me. Yeah.
Okay, all right, that's good. Let me go to this then, which is, I did want to quickly bring in Rod Rosenstein here and the story about, we talked yesterday about the possible conservative House Republicans are looking to look how to impeach Rod Rosenstein, who yesterday said.
Well, wait a second now. You said Steen and Stein. Which is it?
Which is it?
Well, I think he says it's Stein.
Why did you look at me when you asked that?
I think he said. I think he said it's Stein.
You know why?
He said it's Stein, but he'll answer to anything, he said.
All right.
Which reminds me of the lady who was sitting in the restaurant who looked at me and said, "You have got to stop." And I said, "Stop what?" And he said, "Calling him Leonard Bernstein. It's Bernstein." And she was really ripping mad.
I understand it.
Okay. Anyway,
threw me under the bus.
So Rosenstein,
if that is his name,
said, "Hey, the DOJ will not be extorted."
That was a much necessary statement for him to make. I think that he's probably been waiting for the right opportunity to say that, because when you're waking up in the morning and you're going to work and every day you're hearing from the president of the free world how awful your department is, and if you're one of the soldiers on the ground,
how awful you are.
Yeah, if you're a leader and you know and you're seeing the people that you're leading demoralized every single day, something needed to be said, and that was just to me the perfect form for that to be said.
I think that he, again, I think this goes back to the earlier issue. I think that the frustration, and first, you know, it's funny, we talk about the Senate Republicans and the Freedom Caucus as though it's some kind of coalesced, mass that actually all, goes as one.
And not the Wild West?
Yeah.
You mean it isn't?
Well, come on. I mean, the Republican Party, I think everybody can see, is pretty splintered. I don't think.
But not the Freedom Caucus, not that guy Meadows.
Correct.
Not, come
but,
on.
But I'm not sure the Freedom Caucus and Trump's team have ever been on the same page. I'm not sure the Trump's team internally is on the same page. So I think you're implying a level of coordination that I'm not sure exists. But I think the frustration with Rosenstein was...
I thought you said Stein.
Is that what we're going with? I'm sorry.
We don't know.
Okay,
what
go
we're
ahead.
Going with.
Go ahead.
The trouble is, I have to tell you, when you grew up downstate and then you come upstate, you notice upstate a lot more people say Stein than Steen. And it just... I don't know.
So they call that guy Bruce Springsteen?
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
But I think the frustration there was, again, trying to get information, not necessarily the decisions, the prosecutorial decisions, but they're trying to get information. And it's what we were saying before. They have a legitimate oversight function, and they were being frustrated in that function.
Well,
in,
wait
in their
a second.
Opinion.
Did you see this
and,
piece?
And
of...
if that's true, then that is an offense. That go ahead.
Didn't you see that piece of garbage that they put out a couple of hundred pages, which was so clearly, you had the issue of Trump having dictated to the doctor the other day that he was the healthiest guy ever to be president. He was dictating to this group of Nunes people who were, who are so political and just being on that moment. You know that, Rich.
I'm not sure what you're which
his physician. By the way, it's interesting that you brought that up because, when the Justice Department actually went before the courts and had warrants reviewed and
right.
they signed, and there was a lawful raid to Mr. Cohen's offices and home.
Yeah.
That was referred to as breaking in.
Right.
And in his own doctor's office, I'm wondering what he would call that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what the president would call sending over his personal,
Thugs.
Bodyguard and chauffeur yeah. to go retrieve records.
Routine.
Yeah. Routine. And I'm wondering what the Beltway
That's
media what the Beltway media thinks of Sarah Huckabee's explanation for that, and whether they're a little more forgiving about Miss Wolf as a result of the press event that took place yesterday.
Okay, that's mm-hmm. just in. So I didn't realize how well documented, but our own friends at NPR did a whole story on Rosenstein or Rosenstein. They go back to people in the at various hearings, and everybody pronounced it differently. They went back to a 2008 clip when he was on C-SPAN, and he is introducing himself as the U.S. Attorney for Maryland. And he was there on behalf of the Department of Justice. And he said, "Good morning, I'm Rod Rosenstein."
Dilly Dilly.
I just told you that.
Dilly Dilly.
What's the matter with you people? I told you that. Now, is it...
I think he was covering something up.
Now, is it char talk or char talk? Guess what? In the history of my family, nobody has ever figured it out.
Well, it's what you want, right? I mean, it's what, I always have this problem with guests when people say, I'll say, you know, is it this or this? And they say, well, either's fine. I say, well, yeah, but which is right? You know, it's your name. You tell me. Okay. Let's go to other stuff, other stories. And let's talk about this Dr. Raid, because this is a wild story. What?
Great
you
story.
Rolled your eyes.
I don't know. It certainly, I don't put it up there with, you know, the Iranian deal or North Korea or Syria or immigration. But go ahead.
Well, no, but
let's jump.
Okay,
on it.
I agree. But do you feel that it is appropriate to talk about it in the last 3 minutes of our program?
Well, when you set the bar that low, sure.
I think it's appropriate to consider whether or not a state prosecutor will take a look at this and whether this doctor is willing to come forward and file charges.
The biggest issue is that in taking on this story, I have to say the name Harold Bornstein or Bornstein. I don't know, actually. But he is the longtime personal doctor. And he claims that Donald Trump's bodyguard, a Trump Organization lawyer and a third man, conducted a raid of his office in February 2017,
thugs,
seizing 35 years of Trump's medical records. And on top of that, says
who keeps
that
35 years of records around, just in general, right?
Says that, well, have you seen the guy? I mean, I think, you know.
I know.
I think maybe he has a manifesto there somewhere. says that he dictated his own initial doctor's letter. And I don't think anybody was overly surprised about that. When
I think
saw
he dictated it while he was at Woodstock. That's just my...
But I think that the matter of why now is this being said.
Well, it's because of the Ronnie Jackson story, right?
Well, I think it is relevant to the extent that when the authorship of the letter that was apparently, or the response that was apparently, you know, put together by Don Jr., I think when that comes into play, you know, the issue of this doctor and who actually, you know, wrote the letter is going to be relevant. Demonstrates that he's done this before.
But you could have said that months ago when, you know, the first bill of health was...
Well, you know, if you give a doctor that looks like he just walked off the set of Fraggle Rock and, you know, and he's saying this, I actually thought he wrote it. But yeah, now and after reflection.
Right? Well, Hank wrote a letter. He said, hi, panel. When Leonard Bernstein, or Steen, was asked about the proper pronunciation of his name, he responded, either.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. All right, we're out of time, and that's a shame. My thanks to Rich Honan for coming in. David, always good to see you. Jen, thank you very much. Alan, thank you. We'll be back with more show after this.